We live in days when a lot of church statistics are available, and nowadays, as a result of the church growth movement, we know a lot more of what is happening. It's much harder to discover what used to happen, but some research was done in the town of Reading early in the century, and at that stage the Methodists were getting 600 men out every Sunday afternoon. The Church of England Men's Society had also 300 or 400. Those, of course, were the days before the First World War, before the advent even of what was called wireless, let alone television. And it would be true to say that not universally around the world, but that in many parts of the Western world, there is a real crisis in terms of reaching men. In the congregation that I belong to, we have 6 different women's groups, and not a single men's group. The growing edge of the church is the mums and toddlers group. And churches, very often, and ours is one of them, have the reputation of having very good groups like this, and lots of non-Christian women will come and bring their children. They get to know Christian women, and they're brought to the Lord. And in that way, ultimately, their husbands are reached and are brought to Christ. But one of the problems in major cities, and many of you are functioning in a city of approaching a million, but certainly in London, one of the difficulties is that by somebody has commuted home or is driven through rush hour traffic and they've got home at 7 or 8 o'clock at night and had a meal, the last thing they want to do is go out to another meeting. They'd rather put their feet up, read the paper, watch television, whatever. And so the changes in society that we live in are making it much, much harder for us to reach men. The Church of England have wrestled with this problem, and they did something, and I think it's something that you might think of doing, in that they put together a team through a very fine evangelical body called the Church Pastoral Aid Society, and they put together a team of people who had been effective in outreach among men, and they went round holding seminars around the churches in order to try and help different church groups to meet men. We tried various things in our church. We hit the Times Leader because we were running a golf tuition session in the church, and they had a mental picture of a sort of traditional Anglican church with stained glass windows and golf balls whizzing around, and it produced quite a funny Times Leader. We were actually meeting in a much more traditional box where we could wham golf balls about. But somebody else ran a camera course, anything to get hold of people. One of my wife's uncles up in Harrogate is involved in a series of men's forums up there, which attract still several hundred men, mainly people who've retired, but quite a lot of people retire early nowadays. And after all, those who are older need the gospel just as much as those who are younger. So that a substantial effort is being made, and rather effectively there, through men's forums in which Christians are speaking on a variety of interesting topics of one sort or another, and people who are no longer working are looking for things to do, and are thus much more reachable. So that reaching the over 55s, or certainly the over 60s, is relatively easier, and is taking place more effectively. This was an outstanding problem we've had in Japanese work. I mean, working among Japanese business people in Singapore, as I did with my wife for a number of years, my wife had an easy wicket. Because Japanese women were not allowed to work, they didn't have work permits, they were looking for things to do, and they were delighted to have reasons to meet together. The problem was reaching men. Those in construction firms worked 7 days a week. Those who worked 6 days a week usually went and played golf with business associates on the seventh. And the problem was, how do you get hold of these people? And reaching Japanese men, by and large, was a matter of seeing their wives won first. And then the church actually provided the only thing that brought Japanese families to do something together. By and large, men did their business things, men did their recreation, quite apart from their families. And the church was one of the few things, and this was one of the attractions of the church, that in a society which was increasingly sort of shredded apart from itself, that the church provided an opportunity for whole families to meet together and to do things. Now, how any of those things can be applied in your situation, I don't know. But it would seem fairly true that around the world we have a crisis. Christian publishers have a crisis. I think the figure in Britain is something like 3 books out of 4, Christian books out of 4, are read by women, and only 1 in 4 are read by men. And that has certain implications. So that it's the changes in society that we've got around us that around the world have created considerable problems in reaching men with the gospel. So what are we going to do about it? Now, obviously, one could discuss various methods which have been attempted. The Japanese, I was back in Singapore in this Japanese church, and was thrilled that the congregation we saw started was now over the 100 mark, but I was thrilled with the number of men there, and wondered how it had happened. And the way it had happened was actually a men's singing group. There are a number of gifted musicians in the church, and they had started singing and doing things together, and then they'd started inviting people who weren't converted yet, but who wanted to do something with other people. And a number of these non-Christian men had been brought in and saved as a result of this group doing something together in the church. And when I hear about things that are happening in Australia, what was the name of that place you were talking about? Tiare? Tiare, is it? That one of the things that seemed to be happening there was that the church was actually doing something, not just having services. And it may be that we need to think along those lines. Now, obviously, we could just talk about that. But there is a deeper problem, I think, which is the problem of motivation. Today is September the 2nd. And I can think back 50 years tomorrow. And remember, I was down on holiday at the seaside. My father has already gone back to London because the crisis was brewing. And I shall never forget my mother weeping. She could remember the previous war. And I didn't know why she was weeping. I was only, what, 11 and a half at the time. And then there was this war. There was a substantial period when nothing very much seemed to be happening. You know, the Maginot Line was there and the Siegfried Line was there, and we sort of snoozed around, and we'd had all these horror things about all this poison gas that was going to come on us, and we were all absolutely terrified, but none of it happened. And so we more or less, or rationing had come in, and we all kind of carried gas masks around with us, so on, but for months, nothing. A sort of phony war. And I think this is part of the problem in motivating men that we've got. I mean, take that passage, which, if one was thinking about wars, is the very obvious one. In a book that has up to now been talking about walk, 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 suddenly talks about standing and fighting. Finally, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. Therefore, put on the full armor of God so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground, and after you've done everything, to stand. Stand firm, then, with the belt of truth buckled around your waist, with the breastplate of righteousness in place, and with your feet fitted with the readiness that comes from the gospel of peace. In addition to all this, take up the shield of faith with which you can extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one. Take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, and pray through the Spirit on all occasions with all kinds of prayers and requests. With this in mind, be alert and always keep on praying for all the saints. Pray also for me, that whenever I open my mouth, words may be given me, so that I will fearlessly make known the mystery of the gospel, for which I am an ambassador in chains. Pray that I may declare it fearlessly as I should. Now, anybody who has to preach on Ephesians 6 to a Christian middle-class congregation feels that this is pure fantasy. I don't know whether you know, I mentioned it at the meeting on church growth the other day, the evangelism conference. That short story of James Thurber's, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, which Danny Kaye made a marvellous film of, about a man wheeling a trolley around a supermarket, and he wheels the trolley around going pocket to pocket to pocket to pocket in front of him, and he fantasizes. And he sees himself as the hero, lashed to the wheel in a storm at sea. My arm was broken, but that was nothing. Or his wife suddenly disturbs him by bringing some more things for him to put in his trolley, and he shakes up, and then off he goes again, pocket to pocket. And this time he's flying a Spitfire in a dogfight during the Battle of Britain, and so on. But the whole thing is pure fantasy. And it seems to me that in most of our churches, you look at these solid burgers sitting there in rows, and you feel, where is Ephesians 6 in their real experience? They all know it. They say, oh yes, Ephesians 6, the armour of God. They all know it backwards. There's probably lots of them spoken on it. And yet, when you look at the average congregation, or let's bring it nearer home, the average men's group, it's just fantasy. Where on earth is the spiritual battle? So I think that we need to look at a passage like this and say, all right, where is this in our experience? Is this an aspect of life in the New Testament that just doesn't exist in our comfortable middle-class Christianity today? What does it mean, this passage? Now, there's a lot that can be said about the passage, and of course any preacher looking at it, there's all sorts of things, and I've got to leave most of them out. One could say a lot about the fact that it's corporate, that this is not just talking about individual battles, but about corporate battles, and that Roman soldiers didn't sort of trot out all by themselves like this to fight against the Wild Welsh. It wasn't a thing that you went out one by one. The Romans were so effective because they fought together, and it may be that our churches need to learn more of this corporateness. I mean, take this great shield, the Greek word means sort of door, it was a great door-like thing that you had. I mean, there was no good going out with one of those by yourself because the enemy would come round the side. But of course, when the Wild Welsh covered with woad or whatever came over the hillside and the Roman column was going by, the front rank just went down on their knees and there was a row of shields making an impenetrable wall, and the second rank stood up and there was a wall now over 6 feet high, and the third rank stood behind and threw javelins and other things at you over the top. It was because they worked together as a team and they related to each other. Whereas we've had such a, as an accident really of our English Bibles, where it's not clear whether you is singular or plural, we've produced this kind of individualistic Christianity in which we don't work very well together. And the male-female difference comes in here. You know this research they do when they put a lot of little girls in the room together and a lot of little boys in the room together. The little girls all talk to each other and find out a lot of each other, and they chat with each other. The little boys talk a little bit, just enough to be able to play a game together, but without very much real communication. And that problem is with us all our lives. Anna Ford, who's a British television personality, says that men are emotional dwarfs. Well, that's a very feminine point of view. But there is there not, a very real truth in this, that many of us find it very hard to communicate at a real level with each other. And therefore we live our Christianity and we fight our little battles by ourselves. Pilgrim fighting against Apollyon in single combat. And that's not what this passage is about. This passage is about the corporate battle of a congregation together against the spiritual forces ranged against them trying to make the church ineffective. Now, one of the things that makes the church ineffective is the course of this world, which he's referred to earlier in chapter 2. And the course of this world are changes in society that make it harder and more difficult for the church to function effectively. So the kind of way that you could function at the beginning of this century are no longer ways that we can function effectively at this end of the century. And yet sometimes, forgive me, we're still singing 19th century hymns, as we were a moment or two ago. And our churches sometimes have this sort of old world flavour, and we have to be dragged screaming into the 20th century. May I remind you, you'll very soon be in the 21st. We aren't quite into the 20th yet. And so we've got this sort of old world Christianity, you know, the old time religion thing there behind us, which is one of our problems. And we've got to look at the world that we live in now, and how are we going to work in the world that we're in now in fighting this spiritual battle. But you see, there are other problems here. One of the problems is the lack of conviction that there is a war going on at all. And most of our churches function as though we were on a kind of picnic rather than a spiritual battle. And I was ministering at had been invited to run a weekend conference for Methodist preachers. And we took this passage as one of the passages we looked at in a preacher's workshop. And the biggest problem was, I'm afraid, the effect of theological liberalism and Methodism was such that most of them didn't believe there was a devil anymore. They didn't believe there was a war. So there's one of your problems. I'm not suggesting this is a major problem of Queensland Baptists, because by and large you seem pretty solid biblically. But you would have to face the fact that an awful lot of denominations in Australia have been undermined to the extent that obviously if you don't believe there's an enemy, I mean, why you don't, I can't think. Somebody's carrying the business on very effectively. But there is that lack of belief in a spiritual conflict anymore. And the enemy has succeeded very cleverly through propaganda warfare and all of this sort of thing and psychological warfare in undermining all this. The devil is hard at work, but it's all being done on a sort of fifth column basis and underground, so we don't realize it's going on half the time. In our own individual lives, we're probably well aware of those many traps and other things that are set for us. But one of the other problems is this question of morale. This sort of feeling that some people have, that we belong to a dying cause. Why is it that young men and young women are reluctant to commit themselves for full-time service? I mean, I've been fascinated in reading your report. I should be saying more about this on a later evening, but fascinating in reading the report that there is this concern to find people who will go into the college in order they may become Baptist ministers. No mention at that point of overseas mission. I was delighted when it did appear in some of the diagrams that were produced to us yesterday morning in the overheads. But the general state of missions, some of our missionary societies, certainly the English BMS, about yours, has degenerated into an overseas employment agency. There's no clear policy. They just find a little job for somebody somewhere and send out somebody to do it for as many years as it takes. But there's a lack of positive determination to pursue the war and to send people out to save souls, baptize bodies and plant churches. There's a lack of nerve, even in institutional Christianity, even among Baptists, let it be faced. That's certainly true. I'm not saying anything about Australian Baptists. I don't know, and it's probably best I remain in my ignorance. But the situation in Britain is such. My name is mud with the BMS because they invited me to give the annual William Carey lecture, and I gave it. But you see, there is these items of armor. I mean, take the breastplate of righteousness, for example. With the breastplate of righteousness in place. Now, there are all the problems. Does righteousness mean righteousness of justification, righteousness of sanctification, and so on? But it seems to be the plain and obvious meaning of it is this, that if there are glaring moral rents in our armor, that you're a risk. You go into battle with huge great holes in your chainmail, and then you're easy meat. And your weakness inevitably means that the whole group of people, your whole congregation, one of us, a minister, leading member of a congregation, he's found out in moral failure. What does that do for the credibility of the whole Christian cause? One of us has got holes in our breastplate of righteousness because there are things in our lives that we keep hidden from other people. We wouldn't want anybody else in the church to know, but it's there. Well, obviously there is a great weakness in the battle. The question, therefore, of our corporate living of a truly holy life, that Christian homes are clearly better than non-Christian homes, and that isn't always so nowadays. And so the question of the breastplate of righteousness is there, and whether the quality of our Christian living as Christian men and our home life is something which is a shining testimony and witness to others. With some of us it is, but with some of us it isn't. Now there's one of the problems in the battle. Or take this girdle of integrity, the belt of truth buckled around your waist. I don't think this is the objective truth of Scripture, because that's the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. This is the belt of integrity. And you may say, well, that's a funny thing of armor. That isn't armor at all. Well, it is, as a matter of fact, because you attach the breastplate to it and you stick your sword in it, and the belt is rather important. As you know, when you take prisoners, you take their belts away and their boots away so that if they try and run away, their trousers fall down. The belt is very important. I remember we had a man came into one of our churches in Japan, ever so enthusiastic. Opened the home that he shared with his sister for house meetings, and he wanted to get out in the open air and give testimony, and he used to bring non-Christians with him to meetings. We were very impressed with this man. He'd come to us from Hakodate in the Northern Ireland. Till we discovered that the woman he shared a room with wasn't his sister. And his integrity was gone. We didn't even know any more that he came from Hakodate, and he said he came from Hakodate. The fact that he'd been discovered in untruth and a lie at that point destroyed his total credibility. And so the whole question of the totality of our lives, the way we are in our homes, the way we are in business, the way we are in our work, in society, all of that hangs together. And once you've lost your integrity, it's mighty difficult to get it back again. Our credibility. Integrity, you see what a basic thing that is. I've always thought the helmet of salvation is a bit difficult. This was obviously one of Paul's favourite sermons, because he uses the picture in Romans 15 and in 1 Thessalonians, where he calls it the helmet of the hope of salvation. And perhaps I can illustrate what that means and sort of pinpoint this problem a little more by relating to you something that happened during the war, just short of D-Day. General Sir Bernard Montgomery was inspecting troops in the grounds of the school at which I was a schoolboy. And Monty said, after he'd inspected the troops, that he would like to speak to the boys. So, all of us, 900 of us, were all sort of packed into the hall, and in came Monty with his little berry and some metal ribbons down here. And he addressed us all. Know your enemy. The German is the finest fighting man the world has ever known. And it takes somebody like me to beat him. I can remember us boys standing round in groups afterwards and saying, have you ever met such a swell-headed man in your life? What arrogance. I mean, schoolboys can be very penetrating in the way. And our view was, why is this man's big-headed? See? And somebody said, you know, one's never heard such arrogance. The possibility of defeat doesn't seem to have entered his head. And somebody else said, perhaps that's why he's such a good general. The possibility of defeat has never entered his head. And that is what it means to wear the helmet of the hope of salvation. The possibility of defeat doesn't enter your head. But it's entered many of our heads. We've wondered about packing it all in because the church is obviously dying out. It's sort of out of date, it's small, it's sort of petty-minded, you get squabbles, you get fights. Young people don't seem to be coming to the church nowadays. And certainly the younger element face this. better not consider full-time Christian work. It's a dying cause. I mean, there's what, post-Christian Europe where I live. Has the church got a future? Some people doubt it. Just part of the old lifestyle that is disappearing in the face of the contemporary world of the media and the rest. So part of this is a morale problem. Part of your witness and your readiness to stand up and be counted publicly as a Christian where you work and with your neighbours and in society depends on whether or not you've got the helmet of the hope of salvation in your head. Whether you believe the church has got a future. And whether you believe that the gates of hell will how much conflict. It's all been comfortable. Nobody minds us having our little services and running our little thing. If that's what you want to do, if you want to do your thing, you go and do that. But don't interfere with me. People only get uptight when you start speaking to them about it and trying to show that it's relevant to them and that they've got to meet the living God. And that it is given unto man once to die and after that the judgment. People who will speak the truth at funerals. I remember going to my uncle's funeral. He wasn't a believer, and they made no pretense. He may have gone to church at Christmas occasionally, just as a sort of matter of custom. And I remember sitting there writhing at the funeral when the man who was conducting the funeral spoke as though my uncle had been in some sense a Christian. It was horrible. I know a number of us said that because my generation there were quite a few Christians, that when my father died, we wouldn't make any pretense. And that we would thank God for a father who had loved us and who cared for us, and we would thank God for that. But that all we could do for him was not to pretend that he was going to heaven, but to commit him to the mercy of God. And that was all we could do. We had to devise a funeral for a non-Christian. A Christian funeral service for a non-Christian. That was the best we could do. But you see, there's so much humbug there. But if you were to speak the truth at a funeral, how unpopular, what this would bring up. And you've had this kind of thing in Australia when occasionally, I seem to remember, was it Archbishop Marcus Lone was courageous enough to say that he was not going to meet the Pope and he wasn't going to pretend that it didn't matter what you believed. And how unpopular that made him. And the people were ready to stand with him. And if you're ready to stand for Christian truth and really stand for it, you will not be popular, you will not be liked. Then you'll get opposition. Then there will be a battle. But the trouble often is that our Christianity is so comfortable. But if you're going to win a war, you've got to take prisoners. And of course that picture of taking prisoners is one that Paul has used earlier in his letter. As a prisoner for the Lord, an enemy, you see, opposing, going, attacking Christians, and the Lord knocks him off his horse and takes him prisoner on the Damascus Road. And he changes sides. And that picture of warfare comes out again, actually, in 4:7 with the quotation from the Psalms, which is originally about the way David took plunder and prisoners and gave them as spoil and slaves to his followers. And that's the picture that he uses, that Christ, the victorious one, took plunder and prisoners and he gave them as slaves, and the slaves that he gave, among others, were the ministers. They are slaves. He gave, you see, gifts to men. He led captives. He gave gifts. It was he who gave some of these captives to his people to be apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastor, teachers. That's the picture there. The Japanese don't like this. Their translation says he set them up to be. Bringing in the sort of Buddhist Confucian idea of the teacher, and they've messed up the Bible translation because of their cultural view of a hierarchical ministry. But Scripture itself speaks of Christian ministers as the servants of God's people, given to them as slaves. But it's a warfare picture. that you've got to take prisoners. Now, what's the good of just sitting there, you see, and singing hymns and not fighting? Not taking any prisoners. You'll never win the war unless you take some prisoners. And therefore, this whole business of men's evangelism is basic. We've got to take prisoners. We've got to find ways of doing it, by hook or by crook. Somehow we've got to win men for Christ. Now, how we do it, I don't know. The how is a different matter. But the motivation is the crucial thing. That we say, I am committed to battle. I will fight. I will seek to take prisoners. I will wear the armour and the breastplate of righteousness and the girdle of integrity. And I will have the helmet of the hope of salvation. The certainty. Certain hope of salvation on my head. So, at this breakfast this morning, I think we have to face the fact that at the moment, our losses, the losses inflicted on the church by the enemy, exceed the losses that we're inflicting on the enemy. We're losing more men than we are winning. And if you do that for long, I mean, it's a long, slow war of attrition. There aren't many violent battles, I would agree. But we've got to inflict losses on the enemy. And this is the only way that I know to do that, is the way that is outlined in Ephesians chapter 6. And the bit that we always leave out, which is the bit about praying in the Spirit on all occasions with all kinds of prayers and requests, with this in mind, be alert. You see, there's the idea of vigilance, that you're on duty, you're on watch in that situation, and always keep on praying for all the saints. But also, he then asks for prayer for himself, and will you notice that twice he uses the word fearlessly? Paul is afraid that he will be fearful, and he asks that he may be fearless. And one of our problems here, let's face it, is sheer funk, cowardice. That's why we're lousy Christian soldiers. We're afraid to open. And this says that the solution to that is praying. Because this was only an illustration then. I mean, the first Christians didn't go around buckling armour on. It was an illustration for them as it is an illustration for us. So what does it mean? Because we don't go buckling armour on in that. It's figurative. Well, the battle is fought out as we pray together. An emphasis that's come through our assembly several times. But that this is the way that the battle is fought. And that is involved in whenever I open my mouth so that I will fearlessly make known the mystery of the gospel for which I am an ambassador in chains. Pray that I may declare it fearlessly as I should. Now remember that Paul is writing to Christians. He's not appealing for volunteers to become soldiers who will fight. He's saying, you are the army. You are already the Christian soldiers. You may be a shower. I still remember our sergeant. You horrible men, I hate you, son. You're idle, that's what you are, you horrible men. You shower. That was the way our sergeants used to talk to us in the British Army. But isn't it true of us? That we are a fearful shower. That we are scared. We are cowards. We do not speak out for our faith. So this passage comes to us as Christian men with a great challenge, doesn't it? We face a crisis in our churches. The losses that the enemy is inflicting on us are greater than those we're winning back from the enemy's ranks. And we've got to work hard at taking prisoners. And I'm glad now that we're going to engage in that spiritual battle by praying together.